Hello, this week's Bruin Podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Gary Robinson, manager of the Baillie Gifford American Fund and the Baillie Gifford US Growth Trust, and is not intended as investment advice. Gary's got unique insight into some of the most exciting companies in the private and public markets, but bear in mind we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, although Baillie Gifford have had a generally very good COVID crisis through their focus on high growth disruptive stocks, when investing your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned, and future performance may differ from that of the past. But with that said, on with the podcast. Hello everybody, welcome to another Bruin Podcast with me, Guy Foster, the Head of Research here at Bruin Dolphin, and very pleased to be joined by returning guest to the podcast, Baillie Gifford Investment Manager Gary Robinson, who is the co-manager on both the Baillie Gifford American Fund and the Baillie Gifford US Growth Trust. That's an investment trust. So Gary, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Guy.
Well, first of all, we should comment that your performance has been really fantastic before and after this major challenge that the global economy is dealing with. I suppose everybody will be very familiar with some of the stocks which have, probably wrong to say benefited, but certainly proven to be pretty resilient within this challenging period. And obviously, I suppose Amazon's one that people will have a lot of experience with. But perhaps you could talk us through some of the other companies in your portfolio that have also benefited from this challenging situation.
Sure, yeah. Maybe sticking within the e-commerce domain, we've seen growth accelerate across quite a few of our e-commerce holdings. So one example is Wayfair, the online home furnishings retailer, and it's seen its revenue growth rate accelerate from about 20% in the first quarter of the year to about 90% year over year in April, which is really just been a huge pickup. Another company that's geared into e-commerce is Shopify. Shopify provides e-commerce tools that allow merchants to sell online. And it's seen a huge acceleration in the number of new stores that are being created on its platform. And this is because there are lots of retailers that were offline and suddenly they're not able to sell or operate their businesses, and they're looking to transition online, and Shopify is a great way for them to do that. So within the e-commerce domain, there's definitely been a demand spike. But I think, you know, the key question for us as long-term shareholders is this question of whether what we're seeing is actually, you know, the start of a long-term change in behavior patterns or not. And I think one of the things which is underappreciated about e-commerce is just how early we are in the transition online. So, you know, prior to the pandemic, about 15% of retail sales were online in the US. And that's one of the most mature markets. If you look into some emerging markets like India, the figure is much, much lower. And I think, you know, one of the key questions for us to consider is, you know, why is it that penetration is still so low? You know, the internet's been around for a very, very long time. You know, why is it that 85% of shopping in the US is still done offline? And, you know, for me, at least, not in every situation, but in most situations, online shopping offers a superior experience to offline shopping. You know, you can access lower prices, greater selection, and it's often more convenient. And, you know, I think the main reason people still mostly shop offline is because it's because they've always done that way. They've always done it that way, and it's down to habit and it's down to inertia. And what the pandemic has done is it's forced people to break their habits, and it's forced people to try the new way of doing things. And I think that when they do try the new way, a proportion of that demand is going to stick. So to take the Wayfair example again, you know, a relatively large chunk of that 90% year-over-year growth is coming from new customers that are never shopped online with Wayfair before. And I think, what they're finding when they use this service is that it's actually a pretty attractive proposition, and they're coming back and they're shopping on the website again and again, and doing more and more ordering online. And so I think what all of this really boils down to is that it's more than a demand spike in a lot of cases, and it's actually potentially, an acceleration in the digital transformation, or a pull forward of the future.
And how important that is that then for the case for the stocks then? Because they've got, if it's just bringing forward future demand, does it actually make that much difference? Because this growth was essentially always in your expectations, presumably, just at a slightly different pace.
Yeah, I think it's important because, we're talking about potentially years of digital transformation being pulled forward. And yeah. I think it does have an impact on the overall value equation. It's much more impactful than, say, just having a one-off demand spike for a quarter or for a year. When you pull forward, you look at the level of e-commerce penetration in the US, and it's gone from 15 to high 20s, I think, in the space of a few months. So I think that is pretty meaningful, and it's going to serve to reinforce the competitive standing of the companies that are well placed to operate online, I think, because for companies that are on the right side of this change, it's obviously created a period of very strong demand. But companies on the other side of this, the bricks and mortar retailers, are really struggling, and a lot of them are going out of business. And so, the competitive landscape is going to have shifted a long way on the other side of this, and I think that's something which could have quite a meaningful impact on the value of these businesses.
Okay, and you mentioned India there as having low digital penetration. I suppose that in China, there's been more of a sort of a strategy of trying to use e-commerce as a way of bringing growth to the rural communities. So is that potentially what the future of some of these emerging markets could look like?
I think so, yeah. I think that's absolutely right. India is in a very different place from China in terms of e-commerce penetration. E-commerce penetration in China is further ahead than it is in the United States.
And on the flip side, what kind of, I assume even in your portfolio, you must have had some companies that have experienced challenges as a result of this this difficult operating environment.
Yes, I mean, I guess all of the companies in the portfolio are facing challenges in one way or another, whether it's, the sudden shift to home working that we've all had to cope with, that's put strain on organizations. Or whether it's the huge demand spike for companies that have been on the right side of recent demand shifts. We've talked about the e-commerce companies. Amazon's had to hire an additional 175,000 workers over the last few months just to keep up with demand. Another holding in the portfolio is Zoom, the video conferencing company, has been grappling with it's gone from being a niche enterprise software tool to a verb overnight, to critical infrastructure almost overnight. It's had to scale from 10 million peak daily participants at the end of last year to 300 million peak daily participants just last month, and that creates challenges, and we've seen some of that in the news. And then there are a few names in the portfolio which have been on the wrong side of recent demand shifts. So one example would be Lyft, the ride-sharing company. There's not been a lot of ride-sharing going on in the US with everyone in lockdown, and so that's created a big short-term demand headwind for Lyft, where I think the company said in April its revenues were down 75% year over year. And, there's always uncertainty in the world, and companies are always having to deal with challenges periodically. And this is a particularly big one, but, there have been challenges before and there will be challenges again. And I think the critical thing for us is that the companies we invest in are resilient to these sorts of shocks, and they possess the sorts of cultures that will allow them to adapt in the face of changing market circumstances and capitalize on those changes and create opportunities from them. So, when we're analyzing companies, we're really thinking a lot about this question of, the strength of the culture, the adaptability of the business. Because I think in order for a company to be to have the potential to really be a true outlier over the very long term, it's inevitably going to have to come through ups and downs. and it's inevitably going to have to deal with strategic inflection points along the way.
You mentioned Zoom there. I mean, when I suppose everyone will be aware, either at work or socially, I just find that there's any number of different ways in which I can have a video call or conference with friends or colleagues. What's the specific feature of Zoom that makes it a winner in the long term in this market?
I think in the short term, it's really been about a service that finally just works all the time. Video conferencing has been a source of a lot of frustration for employees and consumers historically, because it's difficult to operate. It can be very, very laggy. Most of the historic services haven't performed very well on low speed internet. And so I think what's really enabled breakthrough initially with Zoom has been the fact that they've built a product which has just been able to work and to scale. But over the long term, I think really where the potential lies with Zoom is for it to build a competitive advantage through viral growth, through network effects, and by layering on additional applications over the top of its infrastructure and potentially building out an ecosystem. So it's been presented with this wonderful opportunity where it's gone from being a small-ish company to one which has almost consumer internet type scale with 300 million peak daily participants in April. And I think it's got a wonderful opportunity to now capitalize on that level of usage and really look to build its position as a critical piece of infrastructure and cement its place within the ecosystem.
Can you just comment briefly on the sort of more advertising-based internet companies and how they've performed during the economic slowdown? Are they becoming more cyclical companies as they, after many years of very rapid growth?
I think the digital advertising companies have held up fine through this. There are a couple of opposing forces to think about. In terms of the headwinds, there are obviously a couple of big sectors of the economy which are under severe stress right now. Travel is the obvious one, and companies in the travel sector are not spending a lot on advertising at the moment, and for the big diversified platforms, that's going to present a little bit of a revenue headwind. On the other side of this headwind, you've got this is probably the more relevant consideration for the long term. It's just that people are spending a lot more time online. They're spending a lot more time in the digital realm. And ultimately, advertising follows engagement, it follows eyeballs. So so I think that side of it has helped to offset the other side, the headwinds that these businesses are facing.
And with all that's going on, I can see the race for the development of autonomous vehicles is presumably going on somewhere in the background. Is there anything interesting or exciting that you can update us on in terms of significant developments about that part of the world?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important long-term technology. It's got the potential to reshape not only the transportation industry, but there are going to be second-order effects on industries around that, like the insurance industry, and it could ultimately end up with us designing very different-looking cities in future. So I think it's a fascinating area. We have exposure to it through a few of our holdings at the moment. So we own Alphabet, which is the parent company of Waymo. We also own Tesla in the portfolio, which is pursuing its own self-driving efforts. And then in our US Growth Trust and some of our other investment trusts, we've got a holding in Aurora, which is a self-driving startup, which is run by a very, very talented group of individuals, including Chris Urmson, who was one of the early leaders at Google's Waymo division. In terms of where we are with autonomous technology, I think, this is an area where the pace of change is going to be more gradual rather than sort of in big steps and big leaps. I don't think there's going to be a silver bullet that takes us from a situation where we're all driving our own cars to where we're all being driven around by computers. And that's because, the first sort of 99% of accuracy in self-driving is pretty straightforward. But the next 1% is really, really hard. And And that's because it needs lots and lots of work to explore all of these edge cases, which happen very rarely, which are really important for safety. And so right now, the sorts of things that companies like Tesla are working on are, dealing with complex intersections, dealing with busy malls, dealing with parking lots at sporting events, and so on and so forth.
What are the milestones that need to be passed then for that to become a reality?
I think the most likely route to commercialization here is that we'll see a gradual rollout, starting with the most straightforward use cases and then progressing to the more complex ones. So, Waymo, the self-driving unit inside Alphabet, is already offering its service on top of Lyft's ride-sharing network in Phoenix, in the suburbs of Phoenix. You're with a safety driver. So that's really interesting. But Phoenix is a city with big, long roads that are organized in a grid. And it doesn't really get any bad weather, except for maybe a couple of months in the summer where there are storms. So that's kind of perfect conditions for self-driving cars. It's going to be a different challenge to start rolling out these sorts of services in cities like Boston, which have got bad weather in the winter and really winding roads and historic centres. So I think we'll probably see a gradual rollout of autonomous over a period of many years, starting with the easier use cases and working up to the harder ones. And I think the ride-sharing networks like Lyft and Uber will probably be the ideal sort of deployment network for these services, because you can have a consumer on the one end ordering a ride, and then the network can determine whether that ride is a sort of ride that would be suitable for autonomous. And then it will decide whether to route the autonomous car to you or whether to route a regular car to you. It'll look at factors like, what's the average speed on the roads that you're taking to get from your starting point to your destination? How complex are the intersections, and what's the weather like at that point in time?
Right, and so I guess some of these positions that you've got are competitors in this race. So are you any closer to determining who you think might be in the lead?
Yeah, look, each company is taking a slightly different approach. This is going to be an absolutely enormous market, and one where the volumes probably going to be large enough to support multiple different business models. And I probably wouldn't want to call out a leader or a winner at this stage, but we think that each of Aurora and Tesla and Waymo inside Alphabet are doing really interesting work.
Okay, well, if we move on to a different subject then, different form of transport. You obviously had I'd love to talk to you about SpaceX, because obviously we had this amazing achievement from the company. Before we do so, can you explain which mandates you have exposure to it in, and which ones don't?
Sure. So SpaceX is a private company, and we invest in the company across a number of our different closed-end vehicles or investment trusts. So we have a holding in the US Growth Trust, which I manage, and we also have holdings in Scottish Mortgage, Edinburgh Worldwide, and the Schiehallion Fund.
So then going on, it's performed its first manned launch at the end of May. What's the significance of this, and particularly, from an investment perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it was really exciting to watch. I'd probably describe it as being, in terms of the significance, both monumental and incremental at the same time. And it's monumental in the sense that it's a very important first. It's the first time that any private company has ever sent humans into Earth's orbit. So this is the sort of thing which has only ever been done historically by large nation states. So the fact that SpaceX as a private company has achieved it, I think, is a truly astonishing thing. But it's incremental in the sense that SpaceX has been working towards this since it was founded almost 20 years ago now, and there have been lots of really important steps along the way. They launched their, probably towards the end of the 2000s, they launched the first Falcon 1 rocket into orbit, And then they first delivered cargo to the space station back in 2012. And then, you know, they achieved the first re-landing of a rocket in 2015. And this is the first time that they've sent humans to the space station. And I think all of these steps are really important along the way towards what is the company's ultimate goal. And that's to have a self-sustaining colony of humans on Mars.
And so is that's the business model then, is it? What kind of opportunity is that for an investor? How is it going to be monetized?
Yeah, so I mean, so the commercial launch market itself is pretty big. It's a multi-billion dollar market. So that's companies that are sending satellites up into orbit. And SpaceX has got a pretty big share of that market already. And then there's the partnership with NASA, and you know, NASA's increasingly been looking to partner with commercial organizations and has been awarding large contracts to them. So we saw one, you know, over the weekend with the crewed mission to the International Space Station. And then the latest one to be awarded quite recently was the mission to develop landers for a new moon mission, which I think is due to take place in 2024, and SpaceX was one of three companies that was awarded that. So those are meaningful opportunities, but I guess on a 5 to 10 year horizon, the really critical one for the upside case for SpaceX is Starlink. So Starlink is SpaceX's its plan to launch a constellation of thousands of interlinked satellites into low Earth orbit in order to deliver low latency, high bandwidth internet anywhere on Earth. And you know, the communications market is enormous. It's one of the few industries that's over $1 trillion. And it's currently controlled by lots of regional monopolies who charge very, very high prices. So I think that creates a really, really interesting opportunity. And you know, they've already started working towards this. I think they just had their seventh launch of 60 satellites. And they're looking to be up to almost getting towards sort of 1,500 to 2,000 towards the end of 2020, and then building towards tens of thousands of satellites in time. So that's really, really exciting, and it would help in developed markets to potentially provide a low-cost alternative to a lot of these regional monopolies. But in developing markets, it would also potentially provide access to billions of consumers that don't have access to high-speed internet at the moment. Now, lots of companies have tried to do this historically. So there was a satellite company called Iridium in the 1990s, but they failed. And they failed primarily because, well, they failed to build a sort of mass market offering, and that's primarily because of cost. And the majority of the cost of putting things into orbit comes from the cost of building the rocket itself. And you know, historically, rockets have only been used once. And SpaceX talks about this a lot, and they use the analogy of an airliner. Can you imagine if you flew from, say, London to New York, and at the end of the trip, the airliner was scrapped? You know, that is never going to be economically viable. But that's the way that we've been trying to do space. And so the key to unlocking space and to unlocking the commercial opportunities on the back of space is reusability. And SpaceX's Falcon rockets they're the first and the only reusable orbital class of rockets. And there are some really amazing videos up on YouTube, if you haven't seen them already, of them of SpaceX bringing these rockets back down.
Yeah.
So this reusability is really critical to getting these satellites for Starlink into orbit in a cost-effective way, and no other company can do this at this point, which really puts SpaceX into a unique position in what could potentially be an enormous market.
Well, I think we're running out of time. So, Gary, thank you so much for taking us through all that. All really, really exciting stories, I think really interesting for people to hear about those. So thanks very much. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this a useful discourse, and hopefully you'll join us again on the next Bruin podcast.